Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast that talks to amazing women to help motivate and inspire us as we hear about their lives and influences in a really human kind of way. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today, I'm really excited about, is Kirsty Young. Hello and welcome, Kirsty.
Do you say that to all the influential women? I'm really excited. Hello. It's very nice to be here. Nice to be a guest.
I do not, actually, but I am very excited. And it's just so bizarre to actually, that voice that I listen to all the time in the car is alive in front of me. It's very inspiring.
Well, I find the same thing with voices. I think it's different with voices. They're different, obviously, from faces. There's something about a voice that is so intimate. So if I'm in a room, sometimes here in the offices in Radio 4, and I hear the voice of somebody that I'm used to listening to, you can't help but slightly sort of stiffen your spine and think, oh, hold on a minute. So you're a real person then. It's a funny thing, but I don't ever think about it when it applies to me, obviously. That would be creepy.
Not creepy at all. Now, Kirsty Young is a well-known award-winning Scottish TV and radio broadcaster and has interviewed some of the most famous people in the world as the presenter of the long-running BBC Radio 4 programme, Desert Island Discs. Now, Kirsty, you're usually on the other side of the microphone yourself. With that amazingly soothing and well-known Scottish voice that we love. How does it feel when it's about you?
It feels odd because I first of all think, am I going to have a single thing to say that is either of relevance or importance to anybody listening? And also I'm very comfortable drawing people out.
How did you get started in that dream job then?
Well, I've been doing it for 11 years and my background is mostly in news and current affairs, but also a little bit of features, but mostly news and current affairs. And I was working as a news reader and I had done lots and lots of radio way back when and bits and bobs of radio in the sort of middle part of my working life. And I remember I was on maternity leave actually. And when Sue, the esteemed and wonderful Sue Lawley, decided she was no longer going to do Desert Island Discs. And I, people say, can you remember where you were when Kennedy was shot? I remember where I was when I heard that Sue was stepping down. I was on maternity leave sitting with my new baby, and it was on the Radio 4 News, I think the afternoon news. And I made a joke. I texted my agent and made a joke, sort of saying, have you heard? And sort of thought nothing. Oh, I just had a new baby. I was going back to work as a newsreader. And then a couple of months later, I was asked to have a meeting with Mark Damaser, who was then the head of station. And I thought, well, that's a good sign because I know there's a very good job around and waiting to be filled. And we met up and he started talking to me about Desert Island Discs, which I had listened to. Actually, Sue, I didn't listen to Michael Parkinson, did it for 2 years before him. It was Roy Plumley for 43. So I had begun listening to Desert Island Discs when Sue was doing it for those 18 years. So she was my reference point. And I immediately thought, well, you never really want to take over a job from somebody who's done it brilliantly. You always sort of want to take over a job from somebody who was slightly crappy at it, because then you can at least be a bit better than they were. So I felt I took a bit of a gulp, because taking over from Sue felt like a very big deal. She was very, very good at it and people really liked her doing it and they didn't want her to leave. So they felt like big shoes to fill. But when I was offered it, I immediately said yes. Immediately.
Well, good for you. And what an amazing job you're doing, and big shoes for anyone to ever. Goodness me. So how did you train for your career? Was it always a passion?
No, I think it was much more haphazard than that. When I was at school, I was in the debating team and I wrote for the school newspaper and I was good at English and I was interested in current affairs. All of that would point to the fact that I should have imagined that, yes, you know, working in media or in TV and radio would be the thing for me. I didn't imagine that. I had no reference point for it. I didn't hanker after it simply because I think I never saw people like me in jobs like that. And I never imagined that I would get a job like that. I didn't know how people got those jobs. And I didn't have either the wit or the connections to imagine that it might be something for me. So I left school not really knowing what I was going to do. And I went abroad. I au-paired in Barcelona and in Geneva, and I was always hard working because I had to have a job, but I kind of for about a year and a half drifted a little bit and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And my parents, much to their credit, let me find out what I wanted to do. And I got by complete chance, I got a bit of casual summer work for a guy who lived locally and who I served in the pub when I was doing shifts in the pub. He was a cameraman, very nice guy, Alistair, and his runner, now a showrunner, is the person who actually runs the show. But when I started all those decades back, a showrunner was the person who made grumpy cameramen, and they were all cameramen in those days. Cups of tea, and you labelled up the tape boxes, that's how far back we're going, and you sort of were a general skivvy. And his general skivvy had gone sick, and I hated working in the pub, and I said, well, I'll do that. if you want. So I started doing it on weekends for him, and I was meant to be going to college to study, and I said to my parents, I worked a whole summer for him and I loved it. I was exposed to this whole world I didn't know anything about. I was travelling. It was sport that he filmed, which I wasn't interested in, but I was interested in the mechanism. I was interested in the whole production thing. I sat in on edits. It was just very interesting to me, and I thought, oh, I really like this. The money was obviously rubbish. And I said to my parents, well, the most junior people on these shoots that I work with are all 4 or 5 years older than me. They've all got degrees and they're working as runners too. So I could go to college and then university, or I could keep doing this because I love it. And they said, keep doing that if that's what you want to do, as long as you're earning a living. So that's what I did. So that was when I was 18. And then my first proper job was, after I'd done that for a year and a half, I got a job as a baby researcher. It was at the time when independent production companies were just beginning to be a thing. Margaret Thatcher decreed that 25% of all production should be independent. And so in television, these tiny little production companies were springing up. And one sprung up and I applied for a job as a junior researcher and got it. And that was when I really found my feet. I was surrounded by people like me. For the first time in my life, I sort of sat in an office and I thought, yeah, oh, here I am, I belong in this office. And that was a brilliant job. Little did I know that the company was going to go belly up. I didn't know that, but one of the people I was working with, who was far more experienced than I, said, I've seen this job in the Glasgow Herald, as it was then called, now the Herald newspaper. Look at this, this is great. And it was for a trainee in at the BBC. And I said, yeah, that is great. And he said, well, are you going to apply? And I said, no, I've got a job. And this is great. And he said, I really think you should apply, knowing that my job probably wasn't going to be there in 6 months. And I didn't apply because I didn't have the nerve. It was the BBC. I mean, who works in the BBC? BBC people work in the BBC. And he got me the form and he sat with me while I filled it in, and he drove me to, as it was then, Queen Margaret Drive on the last day of the application, and I put in this application for a job. I thought, I don't even know if I can walk through the front door of the BBC, if I have the nerve to do that. But this very nice colleague of mine sort of made me apply for this job as a trainee radio announcer and newsreader, and I thought, I'll never get that. And I applied and I got an interview. Yeah, I got an interview and there were 700 people applied. So, you know, again, I thought, well, there's no chance. But I did. I got the job. And I think they probably, it was a department at that time that was slightly weighted in favour of males. It wasn't entirely. There were 2 or 3 fabulous female announcers, but quite a lot of male announcers, all a good bit older than me. And so I think it was, you know, timing is everything. So I think when I applied, it was my good fortune that I was a young woman. That was good for me. And I applied and I learned so much. I worked with such a skilled and brilliant group of people. And because it was announcing, it was live. So you really had to build your nerve very quickly. I remember the first time I was reading a news summary and into a budget special on radio. This is radio, of course. And I think I actually did throw up before. I was so nervous. But I was surrounded by brilliant people. And so I could watch and learn and very quickly started to absolutely love radio. Just gripped me. Yeah.
Wow, and it grips us. Now, are we allowed to ask who you've just come off air chatting to?
I've just finished chatting to an incredible woman called Anna Pavord, who is a very renowned writer. She was a columnist for 30 years on both on The Independent and also worked as a journalist on The Observer, but is best known for writing an entirely definitive book called The Tulip, which is a biography actually of the tulip and shows the whole history of European finance and culture through, because of course tulips used to be more expensive, more valuable than gold. And she wrote this incredible book in 1999, but basically is a brilliant writer, writes about landscape and country and gardening, and was a great columnist for many years, and was, I would still be talking to her. I could have spoken to her for 4 hours and we could have run it unedited. So smart, so funny, so dynamic, so thoughtful, very tender about her work, and just very brilliant. A brilliant, brilliant, impressive woman.
Wow, another influential woman for the future,
yes,
there, I think. So isn't it what everyone wants to do, to work with amazingly interesting, fun people?
Yes. I mean, I think the gift to an interviewer, you know, you interview people and I have interviewed many, many people throughout the different parts of my working life. And sometimes we interview people who are not very interesting and we have to try to make that work. And the gift of Desert Island Discs is not just a very clever format that's very elastic. It is also that we have a high bar. So people who are guests are people who've really done stuff. Some are better at articulating that experience than others, but all of them have great substance in their lives. And so that, you know, that is a real gift as an interviewer. I'm interviewing people who have done stuff. And so it's great to be able to start at that point.
Definitely. Now, you've worked for TV2 with Channel 5 and even presented Crime Watch on BBC One for a long time. And you've been on ITV hosting news and quiz shows. So do you have a favourite subject amongst all the current affairs that you work on?
Well, the quiz show was rubbish. And, you know, sometimes you do. I mean, now my favourite thing now is I work in BBC TV now for events. I do live events. So I did Passchendaele this summer, which was the commemoration of 100 years of the Battle of Passchendaele, which we did live from Ypres for 2 days. I did the Queen's 90th birthday last year. So I really like live television. I'm not really somebody who loves stretching out over 3 months, making a documentary and going to 22 different locations. I like to go in and for it to be sharp and to get it done. I think live television works very, very well. I think events, you know, the way we consume television now is so fractured that I think the moments that people come together for big national live events are very, very exciting. So I love that. So my work in TV in events is probably, actually it is, it's my favourite work that I've done in TV. It sort of made me fall in love with TV again. At heart, I am a radio person. I listen to a lot more radio than I watch television. I love TV, but I'm far more particular. I'm not really particular about what I listen to. I have Radio 4 on in every room that I'm in. I'm one of those people with a radio in every room. And sometimes I even get it up on the little iPlayer, the radio app. If I'm moving from room to room and I think I'm going to miss a bit, then I put it on for the walk between rooms. So I'm a bit of a radio anorak, actually. I love radio.
And you love 90ths, because as well as the Queen's 90th, you did Sir David Attenborough's, didn't you?
God. Be still, my beating heart. Love that man. Love that man. In fact, last night I just watched with my daughter, we Planet Earth 2. He's the man, isn't he? I mean, he's a communicator unsurpassed, I think, in the broadcast era. He can communicate fundamentally important and yet highly complex ideas in a way that is so digestible that makes you feel that you are there with him, when in fact, you know, David has forgotten more last Tuesday than I'll ever learn in a lifetime. You know, he carries such a body of significant knowledge in his head, and yet he manages to take us there with him into these extraordinary worlds, and is also a complete laugh and mischievous and delightful and relaxed. He is everything that you would wish him to be. So when I was asked to do his 90th and they said to me, would you like to do it? David would like you to do it. By the time they'd finished that sentence, I'd already said, do you want me now? I'll be there now. I can come to the studio now. I love him. He's wonderful. And I did him for our 70th birthday. That was the first time I met him. Desert Islandis was having its 70th birthday and he was our special guest for our 70th birthday. So I've had the pleasure of knowing him for a few years, and he is everything and more that you could hope for.
Oh, how lovely. Now, how would you suggest helping women or men get into broadcast, or motivate them to take up something that they're passionate about too?
I think getting into broadcasting, I mean, it's such a different landscape. I got into broadcasting as I say, right at the bottom of the rung when I was 19. And that was a really, really brilliant way to do it, because I got to see all the different jobs, and I was extremely badly paid, but I was paid. You know, I just about used to sort of cover my petrol costs to do things, and it was when I was living at home. I think getting in at the bottom is a really good way to do it. And I would say to people that, you know, if you're obviously, I mean, people know it's an incredibly competitive field. The work is interesting and rewarding, and so lots of people want to do it. So I think that you have to be accepting of the fact that getting in at the bottom is actually a good way to get in, and probably the only way you'll get in. So I think don't begin by thinking, I want to be an on-screen reporter or I want to be a producer. Begin by just doing that very simple, straightforward thing of getting your foot on the ladder. And I think the way to do that is, if you're working as a, if you are studying as a student, or if you can use, you know, whatever connections you can use to go and get unpaid work experience initially. I mean, I hate to say unpaid, but it might be the only way. And to get your broadcast hours up. So if you want to be a broadcaster, you know, do hospital radio or do local radio or do your own podcast or do things where you start using what you believe are your skills. And also look at the people that you like. Think, well, I listen to that person. What is it about them that I like? Or when I watch that person, what is it about them that they are doing? That's a really good way to begin to adapt your own style and to work out what makes an effective communicator. And I think, yeah, just be prepared to do really unglamorous, badly paid stuff in the beginning. That's how to do it. And make yourself delightful to be around. Don't be a whinger. And don't consider any job too small for you, really. But I would say, you know, that's applicable in broadcasting. It's applicable whatever you want to do.
Good advice there. Are we allowed to say you're married to successful businessman Nick Jones?
You definitely is that right? Say that. Because it's true.
The founder of Soho House Members yes. Club, to give them a shout out here. So that must really cross over with entertaining amazing people as a perfect combination.
Do you know, it's funny that I don't really think of that, because Nick and I, you know, Nick founded a business when he was young, and it was a small business, and we've been together 19 years, so it was just a very little business when I met him, and it's a much bigger business now. We don't spend lots of time there. I mean, he works he's very, very driven, Nick, and I've never met anybody who really works as hard as him. He's got amazing energy, and I think if you're an entrepreneur and a business person, you do need to have amazing optimism and energy. But then in our free time, we're not kind of swanning around. We're at home. No, we're at home. You know, we're at home with our kids, or we're traveling with our kids, or that's his working life, and it's interesting. You know, he always said, when I say to Nick, because Nick's very dyslexic, so I tend to fill in any forms that we had, and I say, what would you describe your profession as? And he says, caterer. And that's sort of what he is. You know, and that's what Nick started working in kitchens when he was 17. You know, that's what he has done. And that's, he always wanted to have a business, but I think he started down there. And so he's a brilliant businessman, but he's not a swan or a bouter. You know, he's not somebody who's sort of sitting with a cravat and a martini sort of saying, oh, it's Jay-Z. You know, that's not really who he is. He's somebody who runs a business, and it's very hard work, and he's very good at it. And he caters to a media community, the film and TV and writing community, artistic community. And they're a fussy bunch, so it's quite hard work.
Oh, interesting. That's a very different dimension and very down to earth as well. You've interviewed some incredibly influential men and women, haven't you? I mean, what traits did they have that were particularly influential? Because I heard that amazing interview that you did with Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook and writer of Lean In. I mean, she was so real and so emotional, wasn't she? It was so powerful, the grief that she displayed. And you were so stoic and professional. And
well, you've got to hold somebody's hand through that. That is, if somebody, I didn't know Sheryl Sandberg until I met her that day. I liked her enormously. I was very admiring of the fact that she was willing to show that part of herself. You know, she has an incredibly powerful job. You know, the value of that company's stock falls and rises on what she and Mark Zuckerberg say and do on a day-to-day basis. So she is somebody whom the world is very much watching. And I think the fact that she was willing to sit with me and talk about this part of her life, which was the sudden and very, very traumatic death of her husband, and talk about that, you know, young children, a man she was in love with, her whole life was pulled, the rug was pulled from under, and she sat and spoke about that, a very vulnerable part of her, and she became, as anybody who'd listened to it, highly emotional and was comfortable being that publicly. And I thought that was remarkable. And I thought probably only a woman would do that. I don't think I would have had the same experience with the man who'd been through it, and who would have felt, I'm sure, as deeply as she felt it. But she was incredibly open to the process. And there was a point at which I said to her, do you want to continue? And she said, yes, because this is what it's like. And I want people to know this is what it's like. Not because she felt that her pain was any more unique than anybody else's, but because she felt it was the great unspoken taboo that death is so badly dealt with in Western culture, and that actually we need to face up to the trauma that people are going through and accommodate them in that trauma and find a way to allow them to be whatever they need to be, whether it's keeping doing their job or not doing their job for months, or whether it's help that they need with their children, or whether it's just one day. The great piece of advice that she gives at the beginning of the new book that she'd written is not to say to people, how are you? But to say to them, how are you today? She said, because that's what it's like. It is a day to day. So a very, very useful, user-friendly book, and also a really interesting message about a very uncomfortable thing. And I was very admiring of her. But when you, those interviews, the depth of that was very unusual, of her grief and her sorrow. But I think talking to people about difficult things, for me, the way that I approach it is that you are involved, you are allowing them to feel that you will not exploit what it is they are going to say, that you are interested in their version of their lives. You're not going to try to frame it. I mean, there might be times when I say, oh, well, wait, you don't seem like this when you say that, or my impression is this or that. But that's a light touch. What I'm letting people do is tell me what it's like to be living their life in their version. Because there are, you know, Robert Evans, the great movie producer, said that, you know, there's your truth, my truth, and reality, and they're probably all right. You know, that's when I talk to people, it's their story of their life. And that's what I want to hear. It's not, I can't, obviously, we try to get all the available facts and figures correct, but really I'm listening to them talk about in their head what their version of their life is. And I think in order to allow that to be as interesting as it can be, you need to make people feel safe and that they can trust you and that you're not going to exploit it. And that, I think that's the great thing about, you know, print interviews. There has to be a headline and there has to be a top line. And a broadcast interview, the way I get to do it in 45 minutes is that there doesn't need to be a headline. You know, we can try and get people in the round. And so I think that is a much more satisfying, authentic version of somebody. I like listening to broadcast interviews and I like doing them because I think it is a fair representation. And I say to, you know, sometimes castaways come in and they're nervous. And I say to them, well, you know what? If somebody doesn't like you after listening to your design list, they probably wouldn't like you if they met you, you know, because we're showing you, it's you. And if you say something with a note of anger in your voice or you say something with irony and humour, that's going to come across. It's not like black and white where it's written down and you think, ooh, they sound like a bit of a pompous git. If somebody's sending themselves up, you'll hear it in your voice. You'll hear the doubt. You'll hear the pause. And I think that it's as close to meeting the person as you can get. And so hopefully for the castaway, that's satisfying. And certainly for the listener, I hope it's satisfying.
Oh, very much so. And no judgment there on Cheryl and herself. It was amazing. Yeah. Very powerful.
The judgment shouldn't be mine. You know, the listener, that's up to... I'm not there to try. I'm there to try to elicit unexpected and interesting aspects of somebody's life and character. But I'm not, you know, that's it. I mean, what right would I have to say, oh, you seem like, you know, I'm responding to them as a human being, but it's the listener who in the end makes the decision. And it sometimes really surprises me when I talk to people and they say, oh, that guy was awful. And I think, I thought he was fabulous. You know, people, we're all coming to it with our own interpretation.
Definitely. Oh, I've loved so many of yours. You know, I've pulled over in the car. You know, David Beckham was fun. And I don't think he played any of his family's music, did he?
No, he didn't.
And Tom Hanks, Judi Dench.
I was astonished by Tom Hanks.
I was too, about his childhood, actually. And
so sad and so tortured and so much an explanation for why he is who he is and how he's able to tune in. And actually, he was a very giving interview. You mean, God knows how many interviews Tom Hanks has done. But he was absolutely in the moment, which I think probably is the thing that makes him a very effective actor. He was there and therefore he was there. Yes. He was completely engaged, yes, in what was going on between the two of us, in the, yes, questions that I was asking him, in the music that he'd chosen. He was completely in the moment of that. And very, very honest and full of good humour and charming. And I have to say, devilishly attractive.
We won't tell Nick. So what's been the proudest moment of your career or your life then?
Oh, well, they're two very distinctive things. Proudest moment of my career, I think probably doing David's 90th programme, Sir David Attenborough's 90th. I think I felt really incredibly privileged that he wanted me to do it. And I felt, because I'm a broadcaster and he is the broadcaster, that was also, so there was a personal and professional satisfaction in that. And also it's just lovely to spend time with him because it is, and he's Sir David Attenborough. So that was very satisfying.
So can we talk about your other passions? I mean, president of the global children's charity UNICEF,
yes,
I gather.
I'm not global president. I'm president of UNICEF UK. So that's a three-year position. And it was one of my brilliant castaways, a woman called Professor Dame Carol Black, who is a scientist and medic, very brilliant woman. She's now a principal of Newnham College, among the many, many other things that she does. And I was interviewing her, and during the interview, she said, well, you know, and she'd done a lot of incredible things in the sort of early part of her working life. And she said, you know, I think it was really when I was 50 that I started to really find my feet. And I thought, yeah, well, looking at your CV, you've done pretty well before 50. And she said, well, you know, I really started to have courage. And I was asking her for her advice to women. And she said, well, you know, have a go. Don't be put off. Don't think I can't. Think I'm going to have a go. And maybe it won't work out. And maybe it will. So this was a good while later. I was sent a wonderful letter by the chief executive of UNICEF UK that said, you know, we've had a very long think about who we'd like to be our next president. And it was you. I mean, it was completely out of the blue. And I thought, well, do you mean another Kirsty Young? You know, I immediately did that female thing, which is who, me? And then I thought of Carol Black. And I thought, well, of course, I've done quite a lot. I'm a good communicator. I've got a reasonable head on my shoulders. Well, I think a man would automatically say, of course they've asked me. Whereas a woman might say, oh, really? You sure? So I had that whole conversation in my head, and I thought of Carol saying, and you can do it, and try and see if you can do it. And all, because it's very serious. You know, it is a very serious charity. And the people working there are incredibly dynamic, well-intentioned, big-brained, brilliant people. And the idea that I was going to go and be part of that, to me, was, you know, that gave me pause for thought. And I thought, well, you know, we often have conversations about why aren't there more women, nah, nah, and why aren't there more women at the top, and so we should have those conversations. But I thought it ill behoves me to say I don't think I've got the time, it seems slightly intimidating, would I be able to make a good job of it? Don't ever complain again about the fact that there aren't enough women when I was given the chance to step into a senior important role and I didn't take it. I thought that's not the right thing to do. And so I've been doing it now for 2 years, and it's a whole different world to me. And what I do is go out and communicate their message and fundraise. I host sometimes things in Parliament, speak to parliamentarians, go out into the field, see the work they do, help to advise them on how they can communicate their message. And it's completely fascinating. It's a whole other world. I'm incredibly flattered they asked me, and I'm really glad I said yes.
Good for you, and amazing for other women out there to think that you're ever intimidated by anything. It's funny.
Do you not think? I think everybody's intimidated a lot of the time, don't you think?
I think they're just not honest about it, are they?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, you were saying earlier, what's the most important thing I've learned from Castaways? And I got sort of sidetracked, and I have no doubt about the answer to that, which is resilience. That is the most important single defining feature of all of the successful people that I've interviewed, because there's not a single one of them that hasn't had failure and disaster in their life. They all have. They've all had failure. You know, Tom Hanks has had movies that have bombed and rotten reviews, and movies that haven't taken any money that were over budget, or, you know, I've interviewed brilliant business people whose businesses, their first business has failed. People have failed. I've interviewed research scientists who, you know, have won the Nobel Peace Prize, but for 5 years they did research science that went nowhere and they had to abandon it. You know, everybody that I've interviewed on Desert Island Discs has had failure in their life. So it is not the idea that people somehow vault from constant success to constant success. It is that their inbuilt resilience, for whatever reason, if it's reasons of adversity, if it's reasons of upbringing, whatever, enables them to accept that failure is part of success. It's the most important part of success. And I think that idea of resilience is a defining feature of successful people. And I also think self-doubt is really important. The idea about, can I? That's good, isn't it? Because it means you go in taking care to make a good job of it. I mean, if we just sailed into situations thinking, of course, and I'll be brilliant at this, I think self-doubt's crucial. And also it's repulsive for people to think they can succeed at things. I think self-doubt's a good mechanism, I think, yeah.
Wow, fascinating. My goodness. I think you should be doing a book about all of that. So do you have a mantra for living your life? And have you drawn inspiration yourself from being a castaway? What would you take?
Oh, God, what would I take? My list of eight changes regularly. I don't know which book I'd take. No, I'd be a useless cast. I can't think of any of that. No, I've never properly applied my brain to it, because I've never had to. I think if I had to, I really would sit down and have a good old think about it. You know, I don't have a mantra that is a sort of definitive sentence, which is very useless for your purposes. But I suppose it is keeping a sense of proportion and good humour is always really, really important. You know, that sense in which, you know, it's only life. And, you know, nobody died. I'm not a brain surgeon. Nobody died. The worst that can happen is that I make a king-sized idiot of myself doing what I do. That's the worst thing. On live TV, that's the worst thing that can happen. When I'm doing my radio program, if I get my facts and figures wrong, I mean, I always try to be really across the brief, but if I get that wrong, then the worst thing that can happen is they say, no, I didn't. What are you talking about? You know, and that's just me momentarily compromised and, you know, flushed with embarrassment. But that's all it is. I'm not doing, this is not brain surgery. And therefore, keeping a sense of proportion and a sense of humour. I think a sense of humour is crucial at all times.
Brilliant. What about your influences? Who's been the greatest influence in your life?
Of course, it's my mother, which is a horrible responsibility for all mothers, I think. I mean, two females, my mother and my sister. I'm very, very close. I have a big sister and a little brother. I'm in the middle. My sister is my best friend and my confidant, and we share a sense of humour. We can often be found the only two people in the room laughing at something because we are the people who absolutely share a sense of humour. And she is the person I do really rely on my sister enormously. And my mother, of course, has been the biggest influence because she definitely taught me a kind of inner confidence. I think she taught me that my views were valuable and that I have a right to be anywhere, to sit at any table, to do, and that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing. And I think overconfidence can be sickening, but I think a degree of confidence and feeling that you have a right to take up the space in the world that's there for you is a really good thing. I think my mum taught me that. She was a stickler for diction, so that's good. My mum's been a huge influence, and she has a very good sense of humour, and she's a very resilient person. So yes, I think my mum's influence has been enormous.
What's your next goal then, Kirsty?
To make more space in my life. That's it. I don't have enough space.
For children or for other projects?
Well, I'm not having any more children. That boat has sailed. No, to make more space for myself. That's the challenge. That's the absolute ball-breakingly hard thing to do, I think, if you're a woman who works and who has a partner and who has children, is actually where do you have the space? Create a little bit of breathing space and a little bit of... I'll be 50 next year, and that seems increasingly important to me for my own balance and sanity.
And what will you do when you get that? Is there a hobby or something you'll do?
I'd love to learn. I really like walking and I like cooking, but I really would one day love to be able to call myself a gardener. That's how you can tell I'm about to be 50, because gardening seems sexy. That's what I'd like to do. But no, just more space for taking in. It's very easy when you enjoy your job to end up with it taking up a big space in your life. And actually, there are lots of other things that I enjoy. So, finding a bit more space and a bit more tranquility. Those are my aims.
Oh, good luck with those. Thank you, Kirsty Young, for sharing your time and your insights and vision with us today as an influential woman today for Women Tomorrow. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
This Influential Women's podcast is presented by Nikki Bannerman and co-produced with Juliet Nichols. Please keep listening for more podcasts and subscribe for free on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts and Stitcher, and influence other men and women to download, listen and subscribe to our podcast. Thank you.